From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 374, Reaping the Benefits of XP Migration with guest Chris Jackson. Recorded Tuesday, June 17th, 2014. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. I have one of my favorite guests back, Chris Jackson, who's the worldwide lead for enterprise application compatibility, and he's worked with enterprise customers around the world to help them investigate and mitigate application compatibility issues, as well as providing instructional training about Windows application compatibility for numerous industry events. Welcome back, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me back, and it's always good to see you at all those events as well.
Yeah, we bumped into each other at TechEd in Houston.
Yes, that was definitely a turning point conference. It was the first conference we've had post the end of support for Windows XP.
Yeah, I guess that's got to be a huge part of your life, right? Does that suddenly stimulate a whole bunch of calls now saying, oh man, we've got to move these apps, or have they already done that?
I wish I could say that everyone's already done that. We're still kind of finishing off the last parts of it. But the last 6 to 9 months have been, you know, full of all the people sort of frantically putting their final plans together. But for me, it does kind of represent a bit of a new era in that, you know, once people get off, how do they avoid ever having a project of that size again just to move to a new OS?
Right. And I think part of this is XP's longevity was so extreme that we had so much code built so that it only run on that for more than 10 years that I think it's almost like we had cruft built up.
Yeah, well, it's very, very interesting when you sort of think about how the application platform has evolved. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we started in a position where everything was, you know, like a lot of the really interesting innovation was happening in the platform. And if you could just keep up, you got these incredible features for free.
Right.
I mean, this back in the days when we added like a TCP IP stack into the operating system.
Yeah.
I mean, you remember those days. I mean, it was like, if you could keep up, all of a sudden you got free networking.
Yeah. Yeah. These used to be products you had to buy. But
yeah,
and you know, XP even went through a revolution too, because the first version of XP predated the USB standard. We got USB a little later,
with various patches as well. Yes.
Yeah,
you could keep up. You get that for free, right? And even XP SP2 was a big project for some companies.
Yeah, the big security changeover. It was a big deal. It was almost a breaking change of Windows. I feel like they should have called it a new version of Windows at that point.
Yeah, I think it was important that it was free though. Right, but I mean,
yeah, I
think
agree.
Overall that you still had this sense of, you know, now it's calmed down and there's not really any innovation coming in the platform anymore. So the innovation started to happen in the apps, and people would start to build these giant Taj Mahal style applications that were just all encompassing and solving all of the problems in this entire domain. I mean, I'm sure you've met a couple of those.
Yeah, I bet you have too.
Well, and that's the interesting thing, is now innovation's coming in the platform again.
Right.
You know, now if you can keep up, you get free touch. You get free scaling, right? So you scale it up and down to all these different form factors, and there's all kinds of stuff that you get for free if you can keep up. Now we've got this giant legacy of apps designed for a very stable platform.
Cool. Yeah, it is interesting. And you know, the whole idea of we've talked about this past on the show, enterprises starting to adopt tablet form factors. Like, the changes in the platform are not just features, but physicality and way things look. And it's certainly impacting the way we build applications.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how do I keep my old stuff alive as things get weird? Because things have gotten weird.
Well, yeah. Taking and really crossing between durability and agility,
I think,
is the next great frontier, both for the developer. I mean, obviously, they need to figure out how to reuse their existing code. But for the IT pro, who has to be able to light up a platform on which the developer can create all the things that they're being asked to create.
Right. And all too often, I'm finding code bases that are, they're actually moribund. Like, they're not actually being changed. They just need to move them to the new platform. I don't know how often you run into that.
That to me is always the debate, right? We saw it on the client, and now we're starting to see it on the server, is the decision point of, do I just lift and shift?
Yep.
Or do I actually go in and invest? And the reality is nobody, you know, the typical application portfolio is somewhere on the order of 2,500 to 3,000 applications for a large organization.
That is just a boggling number. It's so many.
And that's the rationalized ones. I mean, I think the worst that I have ever seen was an organization that had about 30,000 employees,
yep,
with over 130,000 apps that they thought that they were going to muscle through.
Good Lord. I don't have 130,000 ideas. How do you do that?
A lot of it is, why get rid of that particular version of Adobe Reader when you could have 20 of them?
Well, the goodness knows they spit a new one out every couple of days.
Well, and we're sort of laughable, but there actually are some reasons why you might choose to do that. Because the integration model, and I've actually never done any integration with Adobe Reader, but you know what I had a customer explain to me was, we can buy an SDK and it's really expensive,
right?
Or we can just use DDE and that's free, and they're both fully supported. But the DDE approach is a lot more brittle,
yeah,
and doesn't allow me to keep it up to date. So I have to keep this older version of Reader to go with this application, but elsewhere, I want the newer version. So to consume all the newest content and get all of its features.
This is one of those great CapEx, OpEx debates, right? The capital expenditure of buying the SDK versus the OpEx expenditure of maintaining that brittle system.
Exactly. And there's brittleness all around. I mean, this is sort of the one of the really big waves of conversations we're having is, you just went through, hopefully, and got rid of your XP.
Right.
You know, maybe you went to 7. You went to 7. We're starting to work with quite a few people going to 8.1.
Right.
Which is really exciting because now we can really start talking about, you know, what can you do with the capabilities, you know, on the web apps and on the new, you know, immersive apps, as well as with desktop apps and the advances we've made there. But you've now seen your entire portfolio and you know where the weakest link is. The question is, what are you going to do about it? Like, how are you going to not take this knowledge and throw it away? You know, because I've met so many customers who said, you know, we just made our migration to XP off of Windows 2000 or NT 4 5 years ago or whenever that was. Because a lot of people waited, particularly the people who are just moving now.
Yeah,
they were laggards before too. They didn't just become laggards. They said, you know what, well, we'll take our time, and they threw it away. So they did discovery again. They didn't know what they had. How do you not take this incredibly valuable asset that's understanding your enterprise application portfolio and chuck it out?
Literally toss it out. I mean, I would think once you've done the big push to put that together, you'd want to maintain it.
I certainly would agree with you.
Yeah.
But the question that kind of comes up is, where do you maintain it?
Right. And how do you maintain it? I mean, the tooling's gotten way better. I think Map's amazing. Just the ability to go out, reach into the system and give you some sense of what's out there.
Mm-hmm.
But,
well, kind of the philosophy that I've been trying to espouse is, you know, we really need to start thinking about our apps in a much more of a tiered way and to look at, hey, I've got some of the applications that comprise what I do are going to be, you know, my managed applications. Means I'm going to be on the hook for understanding when the environment changes, what I need to do with this guy.
Right.
You know, I'm going to test it proactively. I'm going to make sure it works, do full regressions. That one's really important. I'm going to put some kind of guarantee, an insurance policy, if you will. And more, those belong in my software distribution, like System Center, right?
Right.
So those will be loaded up and deployed automatically or in an app store, however I choose to get it, whether it's opt-in or whether it's pushed by role, or what have you, and then looking at sort of the categories of the rest, right? My supported applications, the one that I'm okay with you having, I'm not going to look at them beforehand, but if you call me and have a problem, I'll help you out.
Right.
And I'll get them working, right? And we see that a lot of times when we consider, you know, the broader definition of app to include office documents or websites that we don't host that are nonetheless important. And then, you know, the next category of unsupported, don't bother calling us, we're not going to help you, followed by banned, the things I'm doing, software restriction policies or app locker to kind of keep out of the environment.
Yes.
That managed bit, I think we've got down pretty well. That goes in System Center or whatever else you're using. It's the supported part. That's hard. Where does that list live?
Right. I mean, you think ConfigMan and these tools, this is what would effectively manage a list. Those are the templates you're running. They have the apps in them. Isn't that reality?
And that's, you've got a caveat there, too. That's sort of the other interesting thing, is just realizing how many people are underutilizing their configuration manager.
Oh, sure. But also, how many apps just aren't living inside of the template? Like, yeah, I know IT deployed me this machine. Now I got to put my stuff on it.
Or, you know, how do you provision that? I mean, this is what's remarkable to me, is when you think, you know, one of the significant tasks we always do when we talk about, you know, running the app compat portion of a migration project is, you know, well, we've got to find what apps are out there, we've got to rationalize them, and then we need to go through and test them. And the act of going and finding them is unbelievably difficult. And you always scratch your head going, what do you do when you hire somebody new?
Yeah. How do you provision an employee?
And they have to do it, right? Because, you know, people are hiring people.
Yeah,
maybe that's why the economy was as low. We couldn't find the app, so we couldn't hire anybody.
But you also wonder how long they stumble along, too, right? You see these guys that 60, 90, 180 days into the job, and they're only just getting up to speed now because there is no rapid deployment of resources to them.
Yep, or it's ad hoc and really, really expensive.
Yes. So. Well, having somebody around who can't be productive is pretty darn expensive, too. That's more OpEx versus CapEx work.
Precisely. And that's that sort of investment that I really see people making, is, you know, looking at how do I take this experience and just learn from it, right? And start to behave differently so that, you know, now I take this super valuable asset that helps me understand what is it that I have and what should I be managing. And do it much more effective, and just keep introducing more and more automation.
Right.
So that, you know, because the whole point of a platform, right? I mean, who cares about Windows? Who cares about a web browser? What you care about is productivity.
Yeah. And so, going through the process of dealing with this XP migration, which has been quote unquote forced on them by Microsoft, is really an opportunity to gather together what your systems all look like. And hopefully automated enough that you never have to go through this again, that it's just going to be trivial after this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you bring up an interesting point as well, which is the whole is being forced down people's throats, which,
yeah.
I always find that concept interesting.
Yeah. It's been 15 years. 15 years!
Well, even so, there's nothing that's stopping it from running right now. It's, you know, if I go out and I buy what is it? The Hyundais have the 10-year warranty, just like our operating systems do.
Right.
And I can go and buy a Hyundai, and I can drive it for 40 years if I want to.
Yes.
It starts to get expensive, right, over time. Either I have a really significant risk that the car is going to break down.
Yes.
Or, you know, I have to pay a mechanic a lot of money to keep it up.
Yeah, it's not like XP exploded in April of 2014. Those machines are still running.
On a large percentage of our ATM machines.
Yeah, well, there's an interesting debate right there. And just as a migration expert, is the lowest common denominator just running it in XP mode on Win 7, just taking that app and wrapping it effectively in a VM?
I am actually, I really saw people breaking away from the notion of XP mode en masse.
Yeah.
Really a couple years ago, right? Because one of the things that people finally started to get their head around was, XP mode is just an XP virtual machine, and the XP virtual machine expires on the exact same day as your XP physical machine.
Right.
So you have, you know, that was a terrific bridge strategy 5 years ago. And in the past year, it's like you're not buying any extra time. You're actually just adding more work in the critical path towards your XP retirement. You're probably better off just keeping the XP around, and people, you know, mostly figure that out.
Right. Yeah.
The interesting bit was those who went to Server 2003, you know, because that was, you know, that was version equivalent and highly compatible with Windows XP.
Yes.
And now they're staring down July of next year.
Right. And that's still such old software. It's 10 years old. It's 12 years old. Like, it's been a long time.
It has been a long time, and then it all depends on what system services you're needing. I mean, there's a lot of lost opportunity. That I think the challenge that, particularly on the server side, you see is from an app platform perspective, you know, to what extent are you going through and leveraging what the latest server OSs are doing for an existing app to, right. for which you're not writing new code.
Yeah.
And there are some, but, you know, it's not always visible. I mean, there's some of the, you know, less sexy, you know, sort of upgrades and, you know, the less sexy benefits of moving to the latest platforms that nonetheless equal real money.
Such as?
Well, I'll give you a couple examples. One of them of just without even changing anything, just getting to the new OS, mm-hmm. we had one customer who had gone through and looked at, you know, how much power are we sucking out of the tap with our XP devices? And they actually measured it. They put a device at the plug.
Right.
And they took a sampling of them and they said how much power is coming out. And they upgraded the exact same machines. And in their case, it was Windows 7. And they did the same devices, how much power is being sucked out now. And they sucked out less power to the point where they were able to say against our entire desktop estate, we're able to finance our move off of XP in about a year.
Wow. That's big ROI for power cost differences. That's kind of amazing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and arguably, I mean, just to be fair, right, is that arguably, you know, they accepted mostly the default power management settings and we had far more sensible and, you know, ecologically conscious defaults.
Mm-hmm. You it's know, not so that Win 7 is dramatically
some
better.
Of that, but not all of it.
Yeah, I mean, Win 7 is definitely better and more efficient in some respects. But yeah, getting the right settings in place, which they, I guess they could have gone and hand configured if they really wanted to. But mm-hmm. defaults are important for that.
No, absolutely. The other interesting one, and this was even, you know, you didn't get this benefit just by moving to the new platform. But when it comes to the concept of how do I, you know, think about my applications as something that I'm investing in, one of the big things we've been coming off, and we can chat in more depth about this if you're interested, but the web. Right? The web has now been the number one app compat challenge that we're facing. And, you know, we had a lot of conversations with customers talking about, well, why would I want a new web browser? I'm perfectly happy with my, you know, nice vintage 2008 Internet Explorer 8. Why would I ever want something new? And, you know, we ran some numbers with one of the customers saying, listen, moving to HTML5, even if I don't use a single new feature, the syntax is a lot more terse.
Right.
So rather than saying, you know, doc type HTML with a whole bunch of URLs and all these characters and specifying the character encoding and all these sort of generic things that are in every single page, moving from the HTML4 syntax to the HTML5 syntax ended up saving them about 430 or so bytes per web request.
Right.
And they computed that each user was making hundreds, if not thousands of those a day, multiplied by, in their case, 50,000 plus users. And all of a sudden, they're saying, listen, we're paying a bandwidth bill of tens of gigabytes a day for characters that do nothing for us.
Right.
Right. They add no value. So all of a sudden, my bandwidth bill goes down.
Yeah.
And though we as individual users tend to think of, you know, internet connectivity and bandwidth as free and unlimited, it's not actually free and unlimited. Someone's paying for it.
Well, and The HTML5 client, when you do start developing against it, is a much richer client to work with now. And you can argue its deployment model. Like, there's a lot of advantages to building enterprise apps, especially eternal ones, using the modern web technologies available today.
Mm-hmm. Oh, exactly. Yeah. I mean, from I get more capabilities, so I can now get rid of a lot of the ActiveX. You know, I had another customer who said, listen, I've got for my training this hodgepodge of, you know, different ActiveX controls, whether it's Flash or Silverlight, or I've got Reader embedded and all these other things all sort of jammed into the site, and they all are kind of like locking into particular versions. So the entire thing kind of gummed up all of this agility. I can't update the Flash or this site breaks, but this other one needs the new one, and I have all these conflicts. To instead say, I'm just going to make it HTML, and I'm going to have one neck to hang. And I can go right there and get it done. And that greatly simplified it for them to start to really get rid of a lot of the complex interactions, to get rid of the finger pointing syndrome, right? Because that's what drives IT pros nuts,
right.
Is call vendor one, like, oh, that's vendor two's problem. Call
right.
vendor two and they say, oh, no, that's vendor one's problem. And you're
yes.
sitting there in the middle going, really?
Well, and if you've got a site that runs well on IE 8 and it has a problem with a later version of IE, you can there's also compat modes there too, right? You can run in IE 8 mode on IE 11, no problem.
Yeah, well, that was one of the big things that we tried to address is, listen, there's a ton of business value in moving forward. And we saw this, right? And I've been, it's like really, I consider most of my job to be the advocate and the voice for the enterprise customer.
Right.
Right. In the space of the web browser, I think it's really important to have that voice because so much of what you see is from the consumer side. What does Facebook need? All these other, interactive fun sites need?
Sure.
Enterprise is harder, right? Because I'm going to go out and I'm going to buy some on-premise, stick it in my server room software that takes me 3 years to set up and configure in a tens of millions of dollar project. And I'm not going to go fuss around with their HTML. There's
right.
no way. At the same time, if I, go and consume, Office 365 or Google Apps or Salesforce.com, the de facto standard for public websites is we support N or N-1.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've got a problem. This website, business critical, only supports up to IE8. And here's this website, also business critical, only supports 10 or 11 because that's N and N-1.
Right.
What do I choose?
Well, I got to think philosophically, you're better off with the later versions. Although, again, so you wrap it in an IE8 compat layer and you're still alive. It's just that's a workaround. You really want to start building pages that aren't browser version dependent.
Well, if we could eliminate version checks, we get a long way to it. But you're exactly right, which is, we should be able to do both. And that's what historically we've always done well with the browser.
Right.
It's one of the big investments we made for the release that also came out on April 8th, for enterprise mode. I don't know if you've had anyone chatting about that, but that was sort of the next round of app compat is dealing with the browser. And a way to really have an extremely high fidelity compatibility with 8, even better than that which you get just by leveraging the document modes that are built in. So you have really a stable platform and your continuously moving forward platform, right? So enterprise mode, you lock it in, and enterprise mode should allow you to sort of leave it sit there for a while for your on-premise apps. And then what we call edge mode, which is just whatever the latest is what I can use for the ones that are provided by web services that are looking to differentiate by innovation and
yes.
take advantage of the latest browser. Let me have both without
yeah.
making the end user be responsible for picking the right browser for the right app.
Yeah, you don't want to go there. And there is a philosophical discussion in general about building enterprise software that stays N-1. Just because the tooling we have available today and the techniques allow it. It's just not that hard anymore. And the consequences of not doing it are significant.
Mm-hmm.
But I do appreciate, you're not going to get everything there all at once.
Yeah, being able to separate so that that the development happens on your timeline and not the timeline of the browser maker, right?
Yes.
That's the challenge that we hear feedback. And that's why we have all this compatibility craziness, because IE's compatibility is incredibly powerful. Really, I can behave like any browser that's been made since 1999.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how powerful it is. But if you don't know how to manipulate that, what you end up getting is I have this sort of multiple personality disorder, and I'm not sure why IE is behaving differently, right? You've got all kinds of people who, for example, they go to develop their own internal websites, and like, well, IE doesn't do HTML5. Why is done HTML5 since IE9?
Yes.
But by default, the local intranet zone snaps you to compatibility view, which is IE7, which didn't do HTML5.
Right.
So you've put some handcuffs on, and if you don't know, oh, you've got the key in your hand, just unlock it.
Yeah.
You end up constrained, and you continue building more of the legacy web.
And it seems like a good default, but you just need to know that this is how it behaves.
It was a good default at the time, certainly, but it actually, because of the unintended consequence, right, and those happen a lot, this seems like a good idea, but as a result, this happened, we actually reversed the way approach that we did for enterprise mode, and we have a lot of people who are like, can I just put everything in enterprise mode, and we said, no, because even though it makes your job easier right now, one time,
yeah,
what happens is you'll continue to be building for IE8 then.
Yes.
Same way we did for CompatView. So we made it whitelist. We said you're going to have a one-time task of identifying what needs to run in IE8 mode, but everything else will run in IE11 mode.
And everything should be tested in IE11 mode first and only go back to compat if you absolutely have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we even made it easy to, you know, crowdsource that testing because we put, you know, you can turn on via group policy a menu option. And in that same policy, you can say, well, the menu option will report back and tell me some user somewhere, here's the user, here's the website, they put it in enterprise mode. And we can also see if we've turned it back off, right? Because now we've got some good signals. Here's a signal someone put it on and left it on, so it probably worked. Here's a signal someone put it on and turned it off, probably didn't work. So now I can start updating my XML that describes all of the sites that need enterprise mode without having to have it be strictly centrally controlled. I can start to distribute it and have some testers who are like, you know what, use your sites and flick this on and we'll automatically get it. No action required. We'll get all the data.
Absolutely. And you talk about app proliferation, you know, web apps, that's a real serious proliferation. Getting those all even known. It's one thing when it's something that's actually installed on people's machines. It's another thing when it's just a shortcut.
Yeah, or it's manually typed every time.
Yeah, and how do you even know about it to catalog it and test it all?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we've actually been doing some thinking about is trying to provide some of that telemetry without just giving you ludicrous amounts of information. So we're aware of the problem of most browser upgrade projects start with, well, tell me what people are using. Because it can change literally tomorrow. Everyone can just start using a new set of websites. There's
right.
Nothing stopping. There's no installation required. Just navigate somewhere else and start using that.
Yep.
How do I track that? But if I just go to a proxy server and listen in and say, all right, tell me every single URL that people go to, I'm going to get this unholy list, right? That is on the average of 10,000 URLs per user.
Yes. Especially with all the redirects that exist these days in the public web. You know, no URL is one URL anymore. It's redirected half a dozen times. Like, it makes logs horrifyingly ugly.
And there's no standard on what defines a web app, right?
Right.
You can just say everything under, you know, www.thisapp.com is all the same app. You could have a single parent URL, a top-level domain with a single app, like, say, Facebook, or a single, you know, an app that has literally millions of apps sitting under it.
Yeah.
Like, say, a Microsoft.com, there's a huge number of apps that's underneath there.
Yeah.
And everything in between. There's no standard for what defines an app. So you have to go line by line through every URL that gets sent off.
Yeah, there's just no, the host domain's not enough. It's more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. So we're thinking about that. I don't know how well we'll be able to solve it, but certainly we're aware of the conflicting need of, I need to know what's important so I don't change it and break someone. But at the same time, don't show me everything because then I can't afford to look through it.
Yeah, we need some kind of smart data analytics that's looking at this data and showing, well, you hit this set of pages over and over again together. So I suspect that's an app. And, you know, this was a different set of exercises or in a different browser. Like you should be able to extract that from behavior. But that's a clever set of data analytics there.
Or even more cleverness would be required to tie it back to business value, because just going there a lot doesn't necessarily mean you're going there and making money. Otherwise, you know, I would say the number one most critical business app for every organization I know of would be probably something like Facebook or Twitter or all these other things where people spend a lot of time.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. That's where they probably end up. On the other hand, that'd still be useful knowledge. Here's how much time your folks are spending on Facebook or on Twitter. How many of them are actually, quote, social media workers? So it's good to know that. But I think that's an interesting way to wrap this up, actually, Chris, is that some of this is about inventory and sort of understanding the landscape. The other is looking at behaviors and being able to tie the two together.
And that behaviors thing, yeah, I think that really is the core of where everything is driving, is to get away from thinking of apps, as entities that exist, you know, with this set of source code that compiles to this functionality, be it broad or narrow. And I refer to it as the appification of the enterprise.
Right.
You know, so rather than building a giant, you know, here is our enterprise resource planning that does everything. And you go in here to hire people, to fire people, to transfer people, to do everything. It's this one giant megalith with a UI that has to customize itself to every single person. But to instead start thinking about, I'm going to build an app designed to help this person do this task. And I can get it done, and I can design it in a way that's not brittle, right? I want to eliminate brittleness everywhere I find it. If I've gone through and I did my testing off that speed, I'm like, wow, this one was really a pain. It's brittle. I've got it duct taped together, but the brittleness remains. I've got a lot of dependencies, and they're very, very tightly coupled. That's right. A problem. To instead say, here's something I can design it, solve a scenario perfectly. So if I'm a bank, I can make something for the teller to do the teller's primary tasks. And if they need to do something that's out of the ordinary, they can go to a different app to do that task. And it can be very focused on efficiently getting them to do that task, to do it correctly in a way that I can move forward. This whole appification and really rethinking how things come together around user scenarios as opposed to business scenarios,
right,
is the direction I see our most agile and most successful customers going in.
Well, a part of this has got to be, it used to be so difficult to deploy a smart app, to a thick client app out to the world, that you only wanted one, and it had to do everything. Yeah, having multiple apps deployed just became a nightmare. And so, you know, the ERP app was born out of just one place to live. It's a flawed idea, and largely the issue is resolved, but we're still carrying that baggage around.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that was the original migration to the web was, wow, deploying all these DB6 apps is really hard.
Yeah.
Because we don't have good software deployment yet. So let's do it this way, and sort of then not thinking that web browsers would ever change again.
Yeah, you've got to be tolerant to these changes on both ends. And it's funny how a migration off such an old OS has stimulated all of this thinking now about how we never have to go through this again, that we can be flexible on the front end and flexible on the back end and allow these things to change.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got to do it again on the server now, right? We got the server 2003 conversations are already starting, and we've got the same thing. The initial, let's lift and shift. As opposed to, is this the right model for me? Do I need to really start thinking about, you know, hey, I don't want to think at the level of this individual service doing this task. And probably the biggest thing that I see is the handwritten custom data pump, moving data from this physical server to that physical server with some transforms in between. Why do we have custom code doing that?
Yeah. Yeah, it should be simple.
You know, there's third-party stuff, and can we abstract, like, here's storage and here's compute, and can we start to separate those things out so that we have systems based upon tasks as opposed to systems based upon a developer event and a funding and financing event that caused the initial thing to be built.
And have it flexible enough that we can shift the platform with it, and it'll keep moving.
Precisely.
Chris, it's always fun to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming back to Run As.
Always a pleasure, sir.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.